Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board in Eveleth, facilitating business development in northeastern Minnesota.
It's 6 minutes now past 11 o'clock. Good morning. Welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Well, it's been a month now since the Minnesota legislature adjourned without finishing its work. Almost 2 weeks now since it returned for a special session to finish that unfinished work. But here we are, just a week away from the end of the state's budget year, and all that work is still not done. Talks have continued. Legislative leaders have held dozens of meetings. But there's still no agreement on the tax bill or most of the major spending bills that are needed to keep state government operating. And it's come to this. If there isn't a breakthrough in the next few days, the state is facing at least a partial government shutdown a week from Sunday. Joining us this morning from the state capitol to give us an idea of what will or won't happen next week are Minnesota legislative leaders Steve Swigum and Roger Moe. Steve Swigum is the Speaker of the Republican-controlled Minnesota House, and Roger Moe is the majority leader in the DFL-controlled Minnesota Senate. As always, we invite you to join our conversation. If you have a question or comment for the legislative leaders, give us a call here. Our Twin City area number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Or 1-800-242-2828. Let's go up to the state capitol where Speaker Swigum is standing by. Good morning, Mr. Speaker.
Good morning, Gary. Beautiful day.
I understand Senator Moe has been delayed just a tad. So
I'm sure he'll be coming.
So why don't we get started with you. What should, in your mind, what should Minnesotans plan for here? Will there be an agreement reached next week? Will there be an interim agreement reached to keep state government operating without that final agreement, or can we expect a partial government shutdown of government services?
Well, Gary, I crystal balling this is very tough because we certainly have a few days of potential negotiations left. But Gary, I would tell you that from our standpoint, a quote shutdown of government would be the absolute worst of all scenarios. I don't believe that that is going to happen. I believe that we will be able to reasonable people get together and have an agreement here within a few short hours or within the next day or two. Gary, the idea of the interim continuing government, some call it lights on, some call it bright lights, some call it dim lights. I don't think that's a very good idea. Certainly from the House standpoint, we will not be going that way. We want to have an agreement, and we want to do everything possible to reach out to the Senate, to the governor's office, you know, within the realm of our philosophy and within the realm of what we can negotiate as well, to make sure that we do continue state government and have significant historic property tax reform, education reform, and reform of our nursing home system as well.
Mm-hmm. Are you categorically ruling out the so-called lights on option then, Mr. Speaker?
Yes.
Okay. Are you confident that now Attorney General Hatch has taken this matter to court to try to make sure that if there isn't an agreement, that there'll be enough money to keep more state functions operating than otherwise would be the case? Does that take some pressure off you folks?
Now, it may do that. I had a chance to speak with Attorney General Hatch. I believe it was on Wednesday of this week. Both Senator Moe and I had a chance to speak with Mr. Hatch, and Mr. Hatch talked about the intervention, about the continuing of core functions. I think it was core functions that he referred to of government, mm-hmm. including a number of services. And, I'm not sure if it relieves pressure or doesn't relieve pressure. I think Mr. Hatch is appropriately saying is that when you, Gary, look at people's life, safety, health, that those things are very, very important, and government provides some of the health, safety, life aspects to many persons, and that has to continue, and I support Attorney General Hatch in his involvement.
Mr. Speaker, are you surprised at the lack of a public uproar? There have been people, obviously, who are have expressed concern about this, but nobody's out marching in the streets. Are you surprised at that?
Well, while they haven't been marching in the streets, they have been calling my phone. So I want you to know, Gary, that that it's certainly citizens are involved and citizens have called on both sides of the issue, by the way. Both sides of, don't give in any more than you have, and then also certainly from the aspect that you need to cooperate. You need to get it done, government cannot be shut down. It causes great problems in individuals' lives, and I understand that. I recognize that. I feel that. So while there hasn't been marches and there hasn't been demonstrations, there has been a significant number of calls to my offices, and I'm sure to other representatives' offices in relationship to why can't you get it done? Who's not cooperating? We don't really care anymore. Let's just get it done.
House Speaker Steve Swigum joins us from our bureau at the state capitol. Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe has joined us as well. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Gary. Nice to be with you again.
Thank you for stopping by. I asked the Speaker this. I'll ask you, sir, from your perspective, what should Minnesotans plan for here as of next week, the deadline looming and the rest? Should we expect, when all is said and done, that there's going to be an agreement? Should we expect that there's going to be a kind of interim agreement to keep the government operating without that broader agreement? Or should we expect a partial shutdown of the government come July 1?
The Senate has two options. Our first option and our preference is to negotiate out a budget agreement, and that's certainly what we've been trying to do. The only other option we have would be to basically take the base budget, put some sort of an inflation figure in it, and pass that. In other words, making sure that the services are there. We would not move ahead on, any of the changes that maybe some of us would like to see, and we would not be able to undo some of the things we think we probably ought to undo. But it would keep the government going. It would not be disruptive to people's lives, and it certainly would not have an impact on the state's economy, which a shutdown would do. The Senate is not interested and will not participate in shutting down the government.
Mm-hmm. Now, Speaker Swigum just said that the House won't go along with that so-called lights-on agreement. But the Attorney General has gone to court now to try to make sure that if there isn't an agreement, more government services would be provided. Does that take some pressure off both houses, the Senate and the House?
I don't think so. I think the general public wants us to get our work done. I think that's first and foremost. And right now, I don't think the general public is focusing on the nuances of the tax bill or the budget bills like the Speaker and I probably have been focusing on. I think they just generally want us to get our work done, and they want the various services that are provided by government to people to be provided, and to make sure that it doesn't cause a disruption in Minnesota's economy. As we well know, the tourism economy is a big part of our economy, and we certainly don't want to have any disruptions in that area. That's why, as I said, the Senate is not interested in shutting down government. As a matter of fact, starting next week, we intend to start to pass the at least the two budget bills we've agreed upon, and no later than Wednesday, we're going to pass the lights on, or the kind of continuing resolution budget.
So that would be Wednesday you would take that up?
No later than Wednesday, yes.
Mm-hmm. And one more question for both of you before we get to some callers here. And I know this is always tough to explain, but in a nutshell, in layman's terms, can you each explain from your perspective what the heart of the dispute at this point? Speaker Swigum?
Well, I think from the House standpoint, the heart of the dispute is four different reforms, Gary. Reforms that we think are very, very crucial. One be the property tax reform. Certainly the intent and specifics of which we agreed to on a May 25th date, but we're just finding a hard time following through and crossing the T's and dotting the I's. But property tax reform, historic. to the state of Minnesota is numero uno, number one. Then there would be the education reforms that we're looking at, reforms of both from the term standpoint of equity and accountability to the education system. Third of all would be reform to the nursing home system as we, kind of help that system change to address the care for the elderly in the state of Minnesota. And the fourth reform is probably welfare reform. Welfare reform, which we in the House will stand behind. Welfare reform, which was enacted some years ago, 3 years ago, and that it seems like there are others that seem want to back off from welfare reform that we thought was a very, very important move of the state of Minnesota in a relationship to self-sufficiency and making sure that people move towards self-sufficiency and towards work.
Mm-hmm. Senator Moe, in a nutshell, what do you see as being at the heart of the continuing dispute?
Well, as you can tell from both of us, the nutshell gets kind of large when we try to explain it. But I guess the two words that I would use, since the governor or since the speaker made reference to reforms, I would say fairness and stability. Keep in mind, you can have reform without having fairness. And that's our major concern, is that if you're going to have reform, at least have some fairness. And our concern is that in the short run, everybody will see their property taxes go down, but in the long run, the shift will basically occur off of commercial and industrial and basically onto homeowners. So that's a major concern that we have. And the other has to do with stability of education funding, which is why we wanted to link this new statewide tax that's been supported by the Republicans and the governor, why we want to link that to education. So the words I would use that we're working for is fairness in this overall tax budget initiative and then stability of education funding.
We're talking with legislative leaders, Roger Moe, who is the majority leader in the DFL-controlled Minnesota Senate, and Steve Swigum, who is Speaker of the Republican-controlled Minnesota House, trying to get some reading here as to where current negotiations stand and what we might expect next week. Next week, at the end of the week, is the end of the budget period for the state, and the state is now looking at least the prospect of a partial government shutdown. Lots of callers on the line with questions for our legislative leaders. Let me give you the number. Don't call right now because you'll get a busy signal, but try in a couple of minutes. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Matthew, you're first. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I've been kind of watching this, and especially the Jesse Ventura versus the quote-unquote, you know, rest of the government kind of thing, and I'm not sure it's true. For most intents and purposes, at least lately, Jesse Ventura is basically a Republican, with the exception of the right-to-life issues, or whatever you want to call them. The impression I am receiving is that the Republican group is saying, do what we want or we'll shut down the government. And the Democratic group is trying to resist that. This is what I'm getting from out here, and I'm wondering how much truth there is to it.
Okay. Speaker Swigum, do it your way or face a government shutdown. Is that a fair assessment of your position?
Well, Matthew, I don't think that's a fair assessment. I think the assessment of Governor Ventura's involvement probably is, you know, somewhat fair. But the fact that the House, or at least what Matthew is portraying of the question, that the House has the attitude all our way or no way, take the highway, is absolutely wrong. The House is very, very willing and has showed great cooperation in negotiations. We have tried to move towards the Senate position substantially towards their marquee issues over the past couple of weeks. It has not always been met with the same type of response negotiations that we felt ought to be there, but I want Matthew to know for sure that we in the House do not want, absolutely without question, do not want government shutdown. That is not a good scenario at all. On the other hand, the lights on scenario is not a good scenario, nor is a good scenario to have at our fingertips historic property tax and nursing home reform and not be able to do that as well.
Senator Moe, care to comment?
Well, I certainly have an opinion as to whether or not the House has been willing to compromise. I think I have a little bit different opinion than the Speaker as it regards that. I think after all of this is said and done, when they people have a chance to analyze all of the offers, I think it'll be fairly clear that the Senate reached out certainly more than halfway in most all of these categories to reach agreement with the House. So I guess our impression is that it would be exactly the opposite of what the Speaker. We don't feel the House has been very flexible in all of this. But I guess that probably doesn't come as a surprise to your listeners. I would just simply say that, again, I just repeat what I've said, and that is that the Senate will not participate in shutting down the government. The Senate will not participate in disrupting the state's economy. We will negotiate hard, try to get a balanced tax bill that we think has some fairness in it. We're not thrilled about where we're at now. We're not thrilled with the package, but we understand that we want to get this resolved. And if we can't, then certainly we, as I've said before, I've said this 1,000 times over the last 3 weeks, the Senate will not participate in shutting down the government. If the last case scenario for us is we will certainly pass a bill that will keep the basic services provided and the parks open and cause as little disruption as possible in people's lives.
Eric, your question, please.
Yes, my sense is that the legislative body as a whole has really lost touch with its constituency. All persons seem to be pushing for a win-lose type negotiation process, and it shows to me an entire lack of leadership in the group. I guess I'm kind of wondering how your two people here today expect to repair this with the voters the next time they have to face them in an election. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Gentlemen?
Well, Eric, this is Speaker Swigum. I don't think this is about elections at all, and honestly, I'm not looking at it from that aspect of elections. I'm looking at this from the aspect of, again, moving forward Minnesota, doing the reforms, which I think are historic and are in our fingertips, and I'm not approaching it, I guess, from the standpoint of whether it helps elections or hurts elections or what may be in the message from voters from that standpoint. I am interested in the message from citizens. And I talk to citizens all the time. I'm at my office all night long, answering my phone, making calls back. When I do get out, I'm trying to listen to individuals and speak to them. I understand that there is a great diversity of opinion, Eric, but I certainly want you to know, at least from my heart, that I don't think we've lost touch. I can understand where you would say that. I can understand on the outside where you would feel that. But you know, Eric, I'm a farmer. I get back to my farm. I get back to my church. I get back to my kids' ball games. At least when we're not here with the Senator Moe, I do those things. And, you know, I answer my phone and talk to constituents all the time. I was answering my phone until 10:30 last night, Eric. And, I think it would be fair to say that we have a difference of opinion. I think it would be fair to say that maybe both sides have negotiated, compromised beyond what they think they should. Although, you know, I think it would be fair to say that. I don't think it's fair, Eric, to say that we've lost touch.
Sir Mo?
Well, I share Eric's frustration, but then I guess I think we all do. We all share his frustration, and we'd all like to get this resolved. But as I think... all of us know, this building was built so that different opinions could be heard, and sometimes those different opinions have direct conflict. Our job is to entertain all those different opinions in a public forum, find the common denominators, which we hope translates into the kind of law that moves the state forward. We're not particularly thrilled about the tax package. There's no question about it. It is more in keeping with what the Republicans and the governor want than what the Senate wants. We understand that. We're not particularly thrilled about it, but we're willing to move ahead off that, you know, that basic idea. I still believe that the overall agenda that we spelled out during the session, which was a balanced approach, making sure that we had appropriate resources for transportation, housing, and education, as well as money for tax relief, was a better approach than what we're probably going to end up with. But we understand compromise, and we have compromised, and hopefully we can reach agreement. But I'll be very candid. I certainly am not very enthused about what I think is probably going to end up coming out in the tax bill.
Mm-hmm. Without getting into all of the specific details, just in a broad brush form for people like Eric, what about the idea, well, gosh, you know, just split the difference or whatever differences you've got, cut the baby in half here and sign off. Everybody will be a little bit unhappy or a lot unhappy, but you can't just continue to stare at each other across the table. Is that would that idea be way off base, unreasonable, impractical?
Well, I think in some cases you can do that. If it's an appropriation, let's say for how much we're going to put into housing, and the House and the Senate have different numbers, sure, you could split the difference on something like that. That's very difficult to do on some of the language that the House and the Senate might have a strong different opinion on, particularly as it relates to some of the social issues. Mm-hmm. As it relates to this tax bill, it's a little bit tricky because sometimes one of the features they're talking about is to make our property tax system simpler. I'm not sure if that's going to be the net result out of this package. It certainly will compress rates, and that will look simpler. But what the difficulties we're dealing with is when you compress rates, that has a tendency to shift some of the burden of the property taxes, and that's why we are arguing for different ways to cushion those impacts, particularly on kind of average valued homes. So, and you can do that by building in different kinds of systems in the property tax system through the property tax credit, local government aid, and the like. So that's where it gets a little bit difficult, Gary, to just split the difference.
Mr. Speaker, care to comment on that?
Splitting the difference has been done in some categories in some areas. Gary, it's certainly doesn't take much of negotiation skills to do that, if in fact that's the net result. And then of course you have to determine whether where you're splitting the difference from, if that actually happened to be an original position from Pluto or a reasonable position to start with. I think that can be done in negotiations depending upon how you start your initial negotiating position. Let me just give you the one for instance, and there are many, and Roger can point to something else other than what I would.
Mm-hmm.
And he can point to something else where maybe he feels that the Senate has more than split the difference. But one of the hang-ups in the tax area, after we've agreed to the property tax reform, after we've agreed to the compression, is local government aid. Well, local government aid left the House floor at $89 million. It left the Senate floor at $168 million. Now, if you split the difference, you come up at about $129, which the House has basically offered. But the Senate then pumped up their offer by adding another $51 million to $219 million. So they say we should split the difference between $89 and $219, which is $51 million more than it left the Senate floor. Now, I'm sure we could have reduced our number, but we didn't play that game. We're splitting the difference between the bills left the House floor and the Senate floor. We'll do that. Splitting the difference between when they left the House floor and some Senate offer thereafter, I'm not sure that we're willing to do that.
We're speaking this hour with legislative leaders Steve Swigum and Roger Moe. They've joined us from our bureau at the state capitol to try to give us some insight into why the deadlock continues at the Capitol and what we might expect. Next week is the last week of the state's budget year, and if something isn't done, there's going to be at least a partial government shutdown come July 1. Lots of callers on the line with questions for the legislative leaders, and we'll get to more of those questions in just a couple of minutes.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Valley Fair Amusement Park, celebrating their 25th anniversary this year. Valley Fair, 25 years dedicated to the philosophy of a great day of fun for the whole family.
And by the way, don't forget to join online and check out the special web offers next Monday and Tuesday, June 25th. And 26 there at Minnesota Public Radio. This is a test of the emergency alert system. That was a test of the emergency alert system. A nice way now to introduce Greta Cunningham with news headlines. Greta.
Thank you, Gary. Good morning. Saudi Arabia says the investigation of the Khobar Towers bombing 5 years ago is strictly a Saudi matter and the U.S. should not be involved. 19 American servicemen died in the attack. That reaction comes from the Saudi defense minister. He appeared annoyed by the U.S. indictment of 14 people just before the U.S. statute of limitations expires on several charges. U.S. officials yesterday announced the 46-count indictment against 13 Saudis and one Lebanese in the attack, in which a truck bomb blew up just outside a military housing complex. The U.S. and its allies are threatening Russia and two other countries with new sanctions if they don't crack down on money laundering. A 26-nation financial task force that includes the U.S., Britain, Japan, and other industrial powers has issued a report singling out three countries. Russia, the Philippines, and a Pacific Island nation now have until the end of September to make improvements or face tighter sanctions. The new punishments could include requiring U.S. and other banks to gather detailed information before doing business with companies or individuals from the three countries. Pope John Paul is preparing for his 94th foreign visit. He arrives in Ukraine tomorrow. Although Ukraine is making the transition to religious freedom, the nation's Orthodox Church has strongly protested the papal visit. In regional news, Minnetonka-based Cargill says it plans to cut jobs because of weak markets for commodities and food ingredients. The world's largest agribusiness company says that each business unit is reviewing operations, but there's no corporate edict requiring a fixed number of percentages of cuts. Cargill has 85,000 employees operating in more than 60 countries around the world. It has 5,000 employees and managers in Minnesota. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for sunshine statewide with high temperatures in the 70s. Tonight we'll have partly cloudy skies in the northwest with a chance of thunderstorms after midnight, but mostly clear skies elsewhere. Lows tonight ranging from 40 in the north to 50 in the south. Right now in Marshall, it's fair and 66. Winona reports fair skies in 64. Skies are fair in Worthington and 66. And in the Twin Cities, sunshine with a temperature of 68 degrees. Gary, that's a look at the latest news.
All right. Thanks, Greta. 27 minutes before noon. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. And our guests this hour, Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe and Minnesota House Speaker Steve Swigum. Virginia's on the line with a question for the legislative leaders. Virginia, go ahead, please.
Good morning. My question is about property tax. I live in South Minneapolis. I have a home that I've been in 9 years, and from the time I've moved in until now, it has the property tax has gone up every year by $100 or more. In this last year, this preceding year coming, it's going to be another almost $200. Now, the property tax question is this. I have been led to believe that if my house, being worth $107,000, is going to probably have an increase in property tax, as if I would, as opposed to having a house of $175,000 or $200,000, they're going to get a property tax cut. And I want to know if that's true. And then after the answer from both of Mr. Swigum and Mr. Moe, I'd like to make a quick comment.
Okay. Gentlemen, would taxes go up on her house under the legislation you folks are trying to work out?
This is Speaker Swigum, Virginia. The answer is no. You have been led to believe wrongly by whoever led you to believe that. The fact of the matter is that this property tax reform mechanism would provide, and now this is statewide. I don't have South Minneapolis in front of me, but I know statewide the last offer from the House would provide that homes would go down 22% on an average basis statewide. Now, some more than others, yes. But right now in Minnesota, Minnesota is one of only two states in the nation which has differential rates on your homes, on your home value, where in Minnesota we have a differential rate at $76,000. Basically, that says that a house at $76,000 or more, valued at $76,000 or more, is a wealthy house and should be taxed at a different rate than a house at $73,000 or $75,000. Your house is obviously worth a little bit more than that, so Virginia, you're in that wealthy house category. We're trying very, very hard. Part of the reform is to move that number to obviously a much higher threshold, but to say that, you know, homes are homes, and it whether it be rental property, Virginia, and I guess I'm getting off your question a little bit, but I don't know why in the state of Minnesota we tax renters who pay through their rent, so much higher than we do homeowners and tax rate. We do that, and I think that that's inappropriate. So the mechanism that we're trying to come forward with would reduce everybody's property tax values, your taxes, yourself included, Virginia. Now, whether it's 8 or 18 or 28%, we'd have to see the runs in your specific area to know that, but your home taxes would go down.
Agree with that analysis, Senator Moe?
I agree that her taxes will go down, but let me add a couple of things. The degree to the impact is going to be determined by, obviously, where a person lives, and it's hard to say what happens in South Minneapolis is going to be the same as in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. So you have to be a little cautious based upon the taxing jurisdiction, the school districts, and all of the rest. What we're concerned about is that this is a short-term pleasure and long-term pain. Because as you compress the rates, you then have a tendency to shift from those rates that are being brought down, you shift the long-term burden onto those rates that were lower. And in this case, that's exactly what will happen. By bringing down commercial and industrial tax rates to the 2.1 or the 2.0 that we're discussing at this stage of the game, that shifts then onto all of the other classifications. And so homes will pick up a greater portion of the property taxes once this buy-off occurs. Also, both the House and the Senate recognize that the $76,000 cut should have been raised. Houses have gone up in value. But let me just tell you where the Republicans have insisted the line be drawn, and we have gone along with it, at $500,000. I think most people would say a home at $450,000 is probably a little more than the average value home. So there are some differences that we've had, but I think the bottom line is I think that Virginia will have a short-term property tax cut, but I'm concerned in the out years after this buy-off has been phased through.
Virginia, you said you had a quick comment to add on.
Yes, my quick comment is I'm leaning towards Mr. Moe's stance on this, and I have a feeling that he's probably telling the truth, that in the out years it's going to come back and clobber me. And at this point, I can't afford to stay in my home, even though I make $35,000 a year, if my property tax does continue to go up as it has been. And I think that's a shame because I can't even afford to buy this house now.
All right. Thank you, Virginia.
You bet.
Let's move on. Oh, gentlemen, apparently the governor in his radio program says he's going to announce a bold move at 12:15. Any idea what that's about?
I don't know. Going to Texas or Arkansas? I have no idea. No, I don't know. We Gary, very honestly, we met with the governor, both Senator Moe and I met with the governor yesterday in separate meetings, but he did not mention anything to me at that time in relationship to a bold move.
Okay. Denise, your question, please.
Yes, my question is I would like to know why.
Whoops. Denise, your phone has gone bad there. Let's move on to another caller. Maybe we can get back with you. Maybe that'll clear up. Let's go on to Linda here in Minneapolis. Linda, your question.
Good morning. I get kind of frustrated when I hear talk about tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts. Before we talk about funding education, I want to hear what are we doing to fund education so we can adequately educate our children and have a better future for them. I want to hear about that before I hear about all these tax cuts. That's got to be the priority here.
Under Senator Moe, if the Senate were to get all that it wanted in the way of K-12 education funding, would that be enough to satisfy people like Linda?
Well, I thought that we structured a fairly good K-12 funding bill. It's significantly less than what we thought was the appropriate amount. But I think all of what we talked about, whether it was early childhood education, which we would have put considerably more resources in than what the House is willing to go along with, K-12 as well as higher education, all of those are going to be less than what the Senate would want. The House is very clear, and also now the governor has indicated they're not willing to go along with additional resources in the tax bill for K-12 education. We would have preferred that, but we understand that they're not going to go along with that. That's not going to hold us up anymore. What we're concerned right now, then, since we don't believe that we're going to have an adequate amount in education, is we want some stability long-term, which is why we want the linkage of this new Republican Ventura statewide business tax, why we want the linkage of that to funding education in the long run. So really right now, I don't think schools are going to be adequately treated, and I think we're going to see tuition go up considerably based upon these budgets, but that's kind of the state of where we're at right now.
Speaker Swigum, number one, do you think there's enough money in the bills that are being talked about now to adequately fund education?
If it's done equitably and with accountability, I think the answer is that we have adequately put substantial more monies than Governor Ventura to education. Understand that there was a bar that was laid out by the governor early in the legislative session in his recommendations, and the House proposal actually increased that bar, the money going, and now we want to talk just K-12 education, by about fourfold. We're carrying money not only in the education bill. The target in K-12 education now, I think, is $381 million that's been agreed to by House, Senate, and Governor. But in addition to that, we carry a substantial amount of money in the tax bill out of the tax target for relieving tax pressures in education areas, whether that be equalization of debt service, whether it be equalization of operating referendum, whether it be the fold-in, formula fold-in of the $310 million fold-in, the Senate position, that carries money in the tax bill as well. Gary and Linda, I think that the education issue is about three things. It's about adequacy, about accountability for the dollar that's put there, and the House has some very important accountability language, and then equity of the dollar. How the dollar is divided between various school children and districts around the state of Minnesota, and very honestly, there are some school districts which receive substantial more dollars per person and per student than other districts. Now, I understand there'll be always a difference, and there's a reason for some differences, but the disparity that exists is awful great, and we're trying to also address the issue of equity in the education dollar.
Now, very briefly, Mr. Speaker, can you explain why it is that the House has been so reluctant to go along with the Senate idea that if you're going to have a statewide business tax, that money should be used for education to make sure that there's some stability, as Senator Moe says, some stability for long-term education funding in Minnesota?
Well, maybe a couple, three reasons, just very quickly, Gary. First of all, the core of the property tax reform mechanism that we're bringing forward, the property tax relief reduction, and I think reducing property taxes is a pretty good thing to do. You know, it used to be a Democratic idea. Now it's a Republican governor idea. It used to be a Democratic idea, but I don't mind taking over that agenda. But the core of it is that the state will pay the mandated costs of the education cost of the education levy upon the school districts in the state of Minnesota that are then put upon property taxpayers. The state will pay that mandated cost. Why do you want to come forward then with a property tax reform proposal that, one, eliminates the state mandated cost, and then only to follow it up with another state mandated cost, this be on business and seasonal recreational property? It seems to be not consistent with your thought to do that. We do have the concerns about what this entire mechanism is. You know, to be very honest, when we've asked the Senate, both the tax chair, Senator Pogermiller, as well as Senator Moe, you know, about lay out the specifics of how this works. How is this statewide tax going to work? Is it in addition to, in lieu of, money put on the formula? Exactly, you know, how is the statewide tax working? To be very honest, we haven't had real specific and real good responses other than concept of, well, we'll dedicate it to education. But how are we going to do it? You know, we haven't got anything at all in specific of how it's going to be done or how it's going to be worked yet.
Mm-hmm. Senator Moe, quick comment before we get back to
it. Well, quickly, let me respond. Yes, we're particularly glad that the Republicans are finally focusing on the property taxes. Unfortunately, their bill that they passed on the House floor, over almost 50% of the property tax relief went for business. So that's why we felt that had to be restructured. The reason for linking the statewide tax to education is consistent with what the Republicans wanted to do. As you know, they want, on the excess levy referendums that schools, districts can vote, they want commercial and industrial property included in that. And when I asked them why, they said because business benefits from a well-trained, well-educated workforce. Well, that seems to me to make a lot of sense, and I think that's correct. And so if they, in fact, do benefit from a well-trained and well-educated workforce, which is what we all do know, then they ought to be tied in on the statewide tax and dedicated to them.
Joe, your comment, please.
Yeah, I was wondering, seeing as how it's been said, mentioned a lot lately that they've been in session for 5 months and basically haven't done their job, if either one of them are considering introducing legislation that states that when we reach this predicament where we've come to the end of the session and the majority of the important bills haven't been taken care of, that they forfeit their wages and their per diem, because basically they've been there sitting there for 5 months, and except for a few minor bills, they have not done their job. Would either one of them like to comment on that? Thank you.
Gentlemen?
Well, first of all, Joe, and I do understand where you're coming from, Joe. I understand the frustration of not having a product, so let me first tell you that I can empathize and sympathize with your comment. Let me second and third say, though, most importantly, Joe, this is not a job. If it was a job, I'd have no interest of being here. This is a service. This is a citizen part-time service that Senator Moe, myself, and 199 other representatives and senators are interrupting our lives. And Joe, I don't want to diminish your question, but I have to tell you very, very sincerely and from my heart that the salary or the per diem, what's per diem, $56 a day, Roger? Joe, it is not even worth, not even a dime's worth the pain and the frustration that we go through, whether it's negotiating with each other or whether it's leaving our families at home or missing my daughter's basketball game today and the Star of the North games down in Rochester, or not being on the farm to do my real job, not my service, but my job. Joe, I hate to diminish your question, but it just pales. It just pales in consideration to the things that we miss in our lives.
Jeremy,
I could not respond any better than the speaker.
Sue, your comment, please.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, and I have a couple of comments. One of them is that I blame all three of them. I blame the Senate, the House, and more importantly, the governor for lack of leadership on this. But the second comment is, I'm a state employee, and I want it to be known that if they think that the loss of productivity is going to occur when this, if there is a shutdown, it's happening right now as we speak. So I'll just take my comments off the air. Well, and let me explain a little bit further why that is. We're scrambling around trying to make sure that we have everything set up just in case this happens. So thank you. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay. Sue raises, I think, an interesting point that we hear a lot of, and I'd like to have each of you address this. We've heard that the part of the problem here is the lack of leadership from Governor Ventura. As far as you gentlemen are concerned, what is there anything that the governor should have been doing that he hasn't been doing that would have led to an agreement? Senator Moe?
Well, I guess, you know, we work fairly closely with Commissioner Smith from Revenue and Commissioner Wheelock from Finance and the administration's head of their legislative efforts, Mr. Austin. And as long as they're there and engaged, and they certainly have been, I guess that's, and I feel comfortable that they speak on behalf of the governor, then I think, you know, as long as that takes place, I think we have the process moving along. I'm not in the position, nor do I particularly care to make any reference specifically about the governor. He's got good, able, competent people there representing him, and that's really all that's important, I guess, at this stage of the game.
Speaker Swagum?
Yeah, the governor's folks are very ever present. They're good people. They're trying to help us through the negotiations and bridging in the gap. You know, whenever you're trying to do the deal or the agreement or whatever it is on a three-way basis as opposed to a two-way basis, it just puts in more factors. It makes it a little more difficult, and you know, that's kind of the situation we're in right now. But the governor's office has been omnipresent. They've tried to bridge the gap. They've tried to bring us together. They've showing that leadership. Personally, the governor, if a little more involved personally rather than less involved, may have helped, but he's got good folks. I mean, the two commissioners that Senator Moe responded to, Paul Austin from his government relations department, they're good people, and they're working hard at it too, and I think we should recognize the efforts that they are doing rather than not doing.
Did either one of you ever imagine that this dispute would go on this long?
No, my deadline, this is Speaker Swiggum, by the way, my deadline was probably about a month ago, before the end of the regular session, and no, I did not imagine it would go on this long, nor do I imagine that we would even be considering or talking about shutdown of government, but we are here, and, you know, I know that negotiations sometimes go tough. You know, it's funny how you, Gary, you can be so close yet so far away. It's kind of like, you know, the book that went, the best of times, the worst of times. You know, they're both here.
Senator Moe?
No, I obviously we would have preferred to have had this all done by the 21st of May. I think about a week and a half before that deadline, I made an offer to the Speaker that moved the Senate more than halfway down on the expenditure side and more than halfway up on the tax side. I thought that would demonstrate to them our seriousness, and he didn't take the deal, and actually he's going to end up with less on the tax side and probably more on the expenditure side now. So no, we would have preferred to have had this done, but hopefully we can get this resolved in over the next few days. That's our effort.
I was going to say, the legislature is in recess until Monday, but I assume you folks will be meeting over the weekend, chipping away again.
Yes, we will continue to negotiate and to try to find different options, different variables that put this together. This is not unusual when you get down towards the end of any budget session. There are usually a half a dozen things on the tax side and a half a dozen issues on the expenditure side, and then you try to work out more global agreements on all of it. And that's what we're doing now. We'll continue to move things around, and hopefully we'll find the right combination.
Mr. Speaker?
Yeah, we're going to continue throughout the weekend, Gary. You can expect that we will be here this afternoon, this evening, Saturday, Sunday, whatever it takes. You know, the House is willing to negotiate, compromise. I think we have gone more than halfway, like the senator feels that he has gone more than halfway, and I think that we have, we can demonstrate that. We can show that. But, you know, we'll keep working at it. Senator Moe is a decent, reasonable, honorable, good Norwegian. and I know that, you know, we'll make every effort. And if we fail to put together an agreement, a deal, to finish the legislative session, it won't be because of lack of effort.
Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck.
Thank you, Gary.
Minnesota legislative leaders, Roger Moe, he is the majority leader in the Minnesota Senate, and Steve Swiggum, who is the Speaker of the Minnesota House. Reminder, we'll keep you posted on what the governor is going to announce a little later today, apparently about 12:15. And then the governor himself will be in our studios on Monday at 11 o'clock to take your questions. 5 minutes now before 12 o'clock.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 22nd of June, 2001. It's the birthday of novelist Joanna Scott, born in Greenwich, Connecticut, 1960. Her first novel was Fading My Parmachine Bell, in which she adopted the voice of an old backwoods fisherman who's just lost his wife of 53 years. Author of Arrogance, Make Believe, and The Closest Possible Union. It's the birthday of Octavia Butler, born in Pasadena, 1947, one of the few African-American writers in the field of science fiction. Many of her characters are strong black women. Many of her books have been bestsellers, including Pattern Master, Adulthood Rights, and Parable of the Sower. It was on this day in 1944 President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed the Serviceman's Readjustment Act, known as the GI Bill, which provided funds for American veterans to go to college. In 1946 and 47, more than 2.5 million former GIs were students in higher education. It's the birthday of the theatrical producer Joseph Papp, born in Brooklyn, 1921, the founder of the Public Theater. It's the birthday of the author Anne Morrow Lindbergh, born in Englewood, New Jersey, 1906. A shy young woman who had a hard time talking to classmates and would go off and write instead, saying that her writing was a delayed reaction to conversation. Graduated from Smith College and then met and married the most famous man in the world, Charles Lindbergh. She wrote her first book about the experience of flying with him and breaking the transatlantic speed record, North to the Orient. Her book, Gift from the Sea, in 1955, was on the bestseller list for almost 2 years. It's the birthday of the director and screenwriter Billy Wilder, born in Susa, Austria, in 1906. He was a newspaper man. He also wrote scenes for silent films in Berlin and left the city in 1933. He was a Jew, and he saw what the future held. Came to Los Angeles, not speaking any English, started writing for films nonetheless, and was teamed with Charles Brackett, who helped him write The Lost Weekend and Sunset Boulevard. Eventually produced and directed dozens of films, including The Apartment and Some Like It Hot, The 7-Year Itch. Billy Wilder, who said, "I just made pictures I would like to see." And it's the birthday of the war novelist Erich Maria Remarque, born in Osnabrück, Germany, 1898. Served on the Western Front in the German Army during the First World War, was wounded 5 times. After the war, he wrote his novel All Quiet on the Western Front, which sold 3 million copies in 6 weeks in 1929, was translated into 45 languages. The book was banned in Germany after the Nazis came to power, and his German citizenship was revoked. He came to the United States on board the Queen Mary, and well, en route, the Second World War had broken out in Europe. Here's a poem for today by Gerald Lachlan, entitled Where We Are, for Edward Field. I envy those who live in two places, New York, say, and London, Wales and Spain, L.A. and Paris, Hawaii and Switzerland. There is always the anticipation of the change, the chance that what is wrong is the result of where you are. I have always loved both the freshness of arriving and the relief of leaving. With 2 homes, every move would be a homecoming. I'm not even considering the weather, hot or cold, dry or wet. I'm talking about hope. A poem by Gerald Lachlan, Where We Are, from The Iceberg Theory, published by the Lummix Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, produced by Minnesota Public Radio, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International, and made possible by listener support at this public radio station. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch. Regional